utility of the Patriot missile as an anti-missile missile in the first Gulf. Was that the first Gulf War? So he's been debunking official stories for quite a while. He looked at the White House document and did a 14-page quick review of it and said this doesn't prove anything about anything. It's not even really officially a CIA or a DIA document. It's just what the White House threw together to justify their Tomahawk missile launch. I hope you grant me some nuance, because I'm not a zero-sum kind of guy. I don't back Assad because I don't like U.S. policy. Assad's regime is despicable. It's a highly factionalized, militarized elite they have in Damascus and throughout Syria. It's been a powder keg for quite a while, and tripping it with aid to Al-Qaeda types, Salafists who have been studying at the Saudi school for quite a few decades. I guess I will start out with a soliloquy. Got still no Black Agenda report. They haven't even posted their regular hours show up, but something must be going on there. I hope they can get their stuff together. They've taken a little hiatus, spring break. I don't know. So I've got Amy Goodman's short column as well, and then major features from Jeremy Scahill with Dennis Kucinich, and then Robert Perry, I guess, is how I'll run it. So I wanted to say something about the mother of all bombs used in Afghanistan. It looked like it was pretty much a demonstration bomb. Was supposedly developed for a third of $1 billion in development and $16 million a pop, if you call that a pop. It's a variant of the fuel air bomb, which is a cheap bomb to make. In fact, is being used in Syria. It's also called an asphyxiation bomb because the way it aerosolizes fuel and spreads it through the air, it has a huge concussion impact, and it also sucks a lot of the in some areas over a region, all of the oxygen out of the air, and people die of asphyxiation or maybe recover a little bit later after having no oxygen in the air, as well as hit by this concussion. So that may have sucked all the oxygen even out of down into the caves. I don't know how that works. What they do in this case is not take just fuel like gasoline or a high volatile petrochemical, which is the fuel air bomb. I know more about this than I'd like to care to admit, but I guess we should know about what we're doing to the peoples of the world. They take a high explosive and aerosolize that, spread it around widespread area, and then ignite it. And it creates this, as they say, second only to a nuclear explosion. The U.S. used the sons and daughters of this bomb in Iraq. They didn't use this huge, massive one, but they did use these concussive asphyxiation bombs in shock and awe. And it was pretty shocking and pretty awful. And between that and the use of depleted uranium throughout the region, we have a lot of gall talking about chemical and disgusting weapons against civilians. So, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. There was another ICE squad attack in town. I don't know how many people were rounded up, if that happened at all. There was a little demo yesterday at noon, and I wasn't feeling well enough to go. I wish I had. But check in with IMC's page and Brian Dalinar. He seems to get tipped off on this quite early. If you want to be involved in some kind of action to respond to scapegoating of immigrants, it's really disgusting. It's one of the most disgusting aspects of the whole disgusting polity we have right now, in my opinion. All right, without further ado, let's hear Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay. Not a pretty picture as well. Then we'll get to how did I introduce it? Jeremy Scahill will be next, I guess, if I can get that together.
Trump's making good on one of his many campaign promises, promoting unfettered police power. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. As the world focuses on state violence from Syria to Iraq to Yemen to North Korea, the groundwork is being laid in the United States for unchecked state violence here at home. Donald Trump is making good on at least one of his many campaign promises, promoting unfettered police power. His point person on these goals, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, is leading the Justice Department through a tectonic shift, abandoning Obama-era efforts to protect civil and voting rights, threatening more deportations and resuscitating the decades-old failed war on drugs. This week, Sessions told the International Association of Chiefs of Police,
"Unfortunately, in recent years, law enforcement as a whole, I think, has been unfairly maligned and blamed for unacceptable deeds of a few bad actors."
Sherrilyn Ifill, president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"What we see with Attorney General Jeff Sessions is an effort to basically take us back in time. This is a person who's stuck in the 80s and in some instances stuck in the 50s. It's a kind of a retro view of law enforcement and policing in which he's attempting to wipe out the last 30 years of progress in this country to the extent that it's been made. The last 4 years in particular, where we've really been focused on the issue of policing reform."
Much of the recent efforts emanate from the summer of civil unrest in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. There, on August 9th, an unarmed African-American teenager, Michael Brown, was shot dead by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, sparking months of protest. By March 2016, the city of Ferguson and the Justice Department, then under Attorney General Loretta Lynch, entered into a consent decree, quote, "with the shared recognition that the ability of a police department to protect the community it serves is only as strong as the relationship it has with that community," unquote. Before long, right-wing groups like the Heritage Foundation began referring to the Ferguson effect, claiming consent decrees or any other type of judicial or civilian oversight of police actually increases crime by tying the hands of law enforcement. This argument has no basis in fact, but like many of the policies being pursued by the Trump administration, now appears to be guiding official policy. After the death of another young African-American man, Freddie Gray, who suffered serious spinal cord injuries while in Baltimore police custody in April of 2015, more civil unrest and protests led to another consent decree. Sessions attempted to delay implementation of that agreement, but last week a federal judge dismissed the motion. In a March 31st memorandum, Sessions instructed the Justice Department to review all existing or contemplated consent decrees, signaling his intention to undermine the more than 100 such accords agreed to under the Obama administration. Again, Sherrilyn Ifill, president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
"The statute that governs these investigations and consent decrees, like in Baltimore, is called the Law Enforcement Misconduct Statute, 42 U.S.C. 14141. It was enacted actually as part of the 1994 crime bill as a result of the Rodney King assault and the acquittal of those officers in the first trial. That's a statute that authorizes the Attorney General to investigate unconstitutional policing, to engage in these consent decrees. So to the extent that he's a law and order Attorney General, this is a law he's willing to completely ignore."
Norm Stamper knows a thing or two about policing. A 34-year veteran officer, the former Seattle police chief, is author of the book To Protect and Serve: How to Fix America's Police. The Seattle Police Department is under a consent decree, and Stamper says it has done wonders to improve the situation there.
"There's been a 60% reduction in use of force by Seattle police officers. There has been a dramatic decrease in the use of firearms, tasers, and batons."
But here's the kicker.
"Police officers themselves, through the president of the Police Officers Guild, are saying, we're grateful that we're at this stage of our progress."
And the crime rate has continued to go down,
right? The crime rate has continued to go down. Officer injuries are either flat or dropping. So there's been no so-called Ferguson effect or depolicing.
About Sessions, Stamper says,
he's clearly in lockstep with his boss, the president. He is clearly an apologist for the worst kind of policing in this country.
Longtime civil rights attorney Sherrilyn Ifill sums up.
This is what I think Attorney General Sessions will unleash on this country if we are not vigilant and if we are not seriously resistant.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
So that'll be another thing on the Urbana agenda is a new police chief. It's a 30-year veteran. Personally, my interactions with him, I'm glad to see him gone. Using training from Chicago for crisis intervention was really pretty disgusting with the record that Chicago has for their police community interactions. Okay, well, I'm going to go to Plan B here, but I will be kicking off with Jeremy Scahill's segment, Intercepted. They have their usual little skit. I find them blackly humorous, so hope you do too. Perhaps you've not heard them before. Again, I'm going to play only the Dennis Kucinich interview, and I already did a little introduction on that. He's being vilified for shaking Assad's hand, apparently. I don't know. Maybe they didn't. They took tea together, though. Remember when Assad was being groomed as the new face for Syria and all that? His wife was getting written up in Vanity Fair as being so elegant and all. Well, introducing neoliberal policies, which contributed to some of the distress that the people had, as well as the four-year drought, which is, I guess, ongoing. Again, it's a despicable regime. It's been a totally militarized situation for many years, and there are a lot of causes for that. But Chomsky, go back and see Chomsky from a couple of weeks ago on Democracy Now, and he'll point out that there was a negotiation that was begun that would have allowed for a departure of Assad at the time of an election. It was actually considered, but the U.S. Scotched it, and it should have been investigated. It should have been tried, it seems to me. It's like some number of hundreds of thousands of people dead later, and the desolation of the refugees. But here's something completely different.
And gentlemen, introducing the seven group winners competing for best in show at the 100.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over this airfield.
I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons.
You guys love the Tomahawk, don't you?
We all love the Tomahawk.
Oh, it's a great, great weapon, and it's cheap.
Tomahawk missile, we all love it.
Good day for the Tomahawk missile.
I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. I'm about to lose control, and I think I like it. I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. And I know I want to.
They're 18 feet long, 1,000 pounds of ammunition, 2 feet wide.
We love the Tomahawk. They're a precise weapon, terrific weapon.
Plus, it's really easy to drive around. They push a button, boom.
And it makes us proud, finally.
Brilliant strike. That's remarkable.
A restoration of American moral clarity.
America is back.
The Ronald Reagan-like muscle.
This is just classic, classic showmanship. It's not even brinkmanship.
Yeah, I love it. A very strong move, very presidential.
Am I nuts? Or something's wrong with his feet?
I don't think I ever find myself saying this on this, but you, I think
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, he's got two left feet.
That is certainly a first.
Go get him, pal. Man.
I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. I'm about to lose control, and I think I like it.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 12 of Intercepted.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
There's almost nothing that brings the warmongers, the hawks, the elites from both the Democratic and Republican parties together more than a cruise missile strike. Over the past week, we've seen the phenomenal transformation of Democratic Party heavyweights who just days ago were screaming from the mountaintops about the Trump administration effectively being a sleeper cell for Vladimir Putin and the Russians. We've seen them now transform into, at least on this issue, lemmings heaping praise on Trump for his decision to rain cruise missiles down on a Syrian military base that, by the way, was back in operation almost immediately after the strikes ended. Now, that strike, of course, was ordered by Donald Trump, supposedly in response to the chemical weapon attack in Idlib province that the U.S. is saying definitively Bashar al-Assad's forces conducted. There are reports that suggest that somewhere between 30 or 80 plus people were killed in that attack. And the pictures are horrifying. Now, it may very well be the case that, as the U.S. says, so it is. It's completely plausible that this was a chemical weapons attack. I personally believe Bashar al-Assad is a butcher and a war criminal. I wouldn't put it past him to order a chemical weapons strike. I wouldn't. But as we've seen time and again throughout the history of U.S. wars, the public is often not presented with evidence. Not to mention solid evidence that what those in power, the administration, or other powerful individuals, that what they're alleging is actually true or that it's the full truth. As journalists, our job is to hold those in power accountable, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or some other iteration. And part of that means demanding evidence, particularly when it means war or military strikes, when people are going to die, not just U.S. soldiers, but also innocent people on the other end of our missiles and our bombs and our guns. Everyone knows the old adage, trust but verify. For journalists, that shouldn't be the policy. It should be distrust and verify. The great I.F. Stone put it best, all governments lie. And they lie to justify wars and aggression. 1846, Mexico invaded the U.S., lie. 1898, Spain blew up the USS Maine in the Havana harbor of Cuba. Lie. The US opposed fascism in Europe leading up to World War II. Lie. 1964, US warships attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin during Vietnam. Lie. 1990, Iraqi soldiers were ripping Kuwaiti babies from incubators and throwing them on the floor to die. Lie. WMDs in Iraq. Lie. Iraq worked with al-Qaeda. Lie. We don't collect any personal data on Americans, on millions of Americans. Lie. And you know what? Many of these lies took lives. Lots of lives. Millions of lives. And now the Trump administration is pulling out a classic in American war selling. Compare enemy X to Hitler. It doesn't matter if the new Hitler used to be our ally. Enemy X is now Hitler. Panamanian dictator and CIA narco-trafficker Manuel Noriega, when he outlived U.S. interests, he was just like Hitler. Saddam Hussein, after he fell out of favor with the United States and no longer was a worthy ally to kill Iranians, oh, he was Hitler. Slobodan Milosevic, who had all sorts of deals with the Clinton administration before the disintegration of Yugoslavia began, oh, he has to be Hitler too. White House spokesperson Sean Spicer, he took it to another level, though.
we didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons.
Hitler didn't even sink to the level of using chemical weapons. What did you mean by that?
I think when you come to sarin gas, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you.
I'm just going to leave Sean Spicer's insane, ahistoric comments right there, right where they are, and let them speak for themselves. Throughout history, those who have demanded evidence to support these assertions that lead to wars, they've been harassed, scorned, vilified, crucified in the news media and by the powerful elites of both political parties. Some have been accused of being traitors or siding with the enemy. And so many people, so many of the people who have a PhD in being wrong all the time, they're praising Trump right now for his cruise missile strike on Syria. Hillary Clinton, who supported the Iraq War, who promoted the idea that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, Hillary Clinton and almost every prominent congressional Democrat,
making sure that Assad knows when he commits such despicable atrocities, he will pay a price, is the right thing to do.
Leaders of liberal think tanks.
In this case, I think that this was the right thing.
I think Donald Trump became president of the United States. I think this was actually a big moment.
So I would be doing everything I could on every front to increase our leverage. Because in the Middle East, if you're trying to do diplomacy without leverage, you're playing baseball without a bat.
Have joined along with famed neocons like William Kristol and hawks like John McCain and Lindsey Graham.
It's the beginning of a departure from the failed policies of the last 8 years.
The only constitutional requirement that exists regarding war is for Congress to put the nation in a declared state of war.
And they're all back together again, cheering this war on. Now, given this history, shouldn't we seek out dissenting voices and listen to what they have to say while the decisions are being made, while history is unfolding in front of us? Dissidents are often right. Not always, but dissidents often turn out to be right. The only member of Congress that is questioning the official narrative about the Syria chemical weapons attack is Hawaii Congresswoman and combat veteran Tulsi Gabbard.
We as the American people should be concerned when any president of the United States launches an illegal and unconstitutional military strike against a foreign government. This is something that Congress has not authorized, and it's an escalation of a counterproductive regime change war in Syria that our country's been waging for years. First, for many years, through the CIA covertly, and now overtly through President Trump's reckless military strike.
A few months ago, Tulsi Gabbard visited Syria, and she met with Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. And boy, did the knives come out for Tulsi Gabbard ever since, including those from her own party, and it just intensified when she spoke out against Donald Trump's cruise missile attack.
Howard, how do you respond to Tulsi Gabbard?
I think it's outrageous. There's a long, well-known history, both in our intelligence committee, Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders. Every single one of these agencies has said that Assad is using chemical weapons. He's a barbarian. He's murdered 500,000 of his own people. I can't imagine how you could make a statement like that, especially being on the Foreign Relations Committee. I can't imagine what could possibly have been going through her head.
So you said that Gabbard should not be in Congress, that this is a disgrace. All she's asking for is proof, though.
If you're on the Foreign Relations Committee and you haven't seen the proof in the last 5.5 years that Assad is a butcher and used chemical weapons, there's something the matter with you.
Now, I'm sure I'm going to get attacked for this, and frankly, I don't care. But I believe that especially right now, we need to act upon the principle that we need to see evidence, that we need to question deeply decisions that lead to war or military action, especially given the fact that we have an expanding number of U.S. wars being waged, both covert and overt, around the globe today. So we're going to focus our entire show today on Syria. And we're going to hear conflicting perspectives. We're going to hear very different points of view on what happened in Syria and what should happen in Syria. And some of these views get almost no airplay in the corporate media. We begin the show with a politician whose entire career has embodied the necessity of dissent. Former Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich, he voted against the Patriot Act. He opposed the 1999 Kosovo bombing by Bill Clinton. He opposed the Iraq War, the drone wars. He's one of the few members of Congress who's voted against congressional resolutions supporting Israel. He opposed the Obama administration's war in Libya, and he has consistently opposed support for U.S. client states around the world. Dennis served 8 terms in the U.S. Congress, and he ultimately lost his seat after a redistricting. Dennis Kucinich has run twice for the Democratic nomination for president of the United States, and lately he's been in the news because of this. Back in 2013, Kucinich met with Bashar al-Assad in Damascus, and he interviewed Assad. And Kucinich, during that interview, pressed Assad exactly on this issue, on his commitment to give up chemical weapons.
Can you tell us now, do you have chemical weapons or don't you?
Well, when we joined the treaty last week, it means that we have, and we said that. So it's not a secret anymore.
So as far as the American people, you will agree that you do have a stockpile of chemical weapons?
Well, that's why we joined the international agreement.
So you would say that President Obama then can trust you to follow through?
I don't think that President Obama should trust me first. The Syrian people should trust me, not President Obama.
Well, a few months ago, Kucinich accompanied Tulsi Gabbard on her visit to Syria. And once again, they met Bashar al-Assad. Dennis Kucinich joins me now. Dennis, welcome to Intercepted.
Thank you very much. Great to join you, Jeremy.
Do you believe that this was a chemical weapons attack by Assad's Air Force or military on April 4th?
No. And here's why. Because Syria had been winning on the ground. They had a major battle that was a turnaround moment in Aleppo. And it would go against everything that makes sense militarily and politically to engage in a chemical weapons attack.
Do you believe that Assad has ever used chemical weapons during his time as president of Syria?
I don't believe so, but I have to tell you, it's up for debate. So my concern is this. The rush to judgment and the absolute refusal to ask for an independent inquiry, to promote an independent investigation, to demand access to the forensics of it, raises questions about whether there was an agenda and whether or not this was, in fact, a false flag attack.
And if it was a false flag attack, what would the agenda be and who is most likely to have conducted it?
I don't know that there was, but I certainly have to tell you that based on all the circumstances, you can't rule it out. I mean, the gas attack was horrible, terrible, horrific. And America, American people have a big heart. You've got elements that are aware of the sensitivities of the American people, and if they can try to prey on that and suck our country into a broader participation in a war, they'll do it. So I think that, you have to go back to 2013. That gas attack was used to try to draw the UK into bombing Syria. Their parliament said no. We have to look at timing. In 2013, there were weapons inspectors in the vicinity, which would make a gas attack by the government crazy. And this time, 2017, Syria had ISIS on the back foot. Talks have been proceeding to try to end the war. It just makes no sense at all. And if something doesn't make military sense or political sense, you just have to ask, is there some other process going on that is intended to develop a wag the dog scenario that draws countries in based on an emotional response to what appears to be a horrific attack?
Now, you're no stranger to standing alone in the Congress in opposition to otherwise popular militaristic policies. But on this issue of the chemical weapons, the entire political establishment seems to have quickly reached a consensus that this is a fact that chemical weapons were used. And you have a number of organizations, Bellingcat and others, that analyze the reporting of Cy Hirsch and the MIT analysis that you're citing, and they say that's just fallacious science and it doesn't hold up. What do you say both to the political supporters of this strike who are asserting that Assad did use chemical weapons, and also to the people who say, well, we've got our own scientists that are saying that that's just gibberish, that whether it's Cy Hirsch or you or Reese Ehrlich, that you guys are basically just cherry picking people who are going to be critical of the dominant narrative?
If the response to the assumption of a chemical weapon attack is a military strike, then certainly it brings in a higher level of responsibility on the part of America to demand an independent inquiry, to ask for the forensics, to ask for access to the site, to take samples of fragments, to take tissue samples, to interview witnesses, to interview victims. I mean, all these things should have been done. And the fact that there was a rush to judgment and they weren't done does raise serious questions. If you believe in the rule of law, then civilized nations, as President Trump liked to refer to, do not proceed in a response by violating international law with a military strike. We had an obligation to go in and get the details. And then once that happens, you take that information to the UN Security Council and, if necessary, to The Hague to begin prosecution. But none of that was done. And I'll tell you what it reminds me of, Jeremy. You know, yes, I mean, I'm probably one of the few people out there, as well as Tulsi Gabbard, saying, look, slow down. We don't know for sure. And when the entire Washington establishment is aligned, going in the other direction, kind of reminds me of Iraq. And I did a report in 2002 that looked at all the available intelligence and everything that was on the record and a few things that weren't. And there was no proof that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11, Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. Iraq didn't have the intention or capability of attacking the United States and didn't have weapons of mass destruction, as it well turned out. The moment has the same feeling. And it has a similar feeling to Libya, where, you know, Gaddafi was going to slaughter people, and that was just a pretext for being able to go after Libya. And what we're really looking here are pretexts for running an agenda of regime change. And the thing that I think is the most ironic about all this, Saudi Arabia sits with President Trump and approves of his missile strike. Well, hello, Saudi Arabia, as well as Qatar and Turkey, the U.S. back channel and the U.K. have been helping to fund these so-called moderate groups who end up being cousins to ISIS, al-Qaeda, and al-Nusra. And they're trying to take over the government of Syria, which, like it or not, is a pluralistic society where people can worship freely. But there's some obvious incongruities here that do not argue for further military intervention in any case, and certainly argue for a patient, calm, and deep and detailed investigation.
What is it that, you know, about someone like Tulsi Gabbard or yourself that you're immediately assumed to be a nut, and all the people who've been so wrong for so long are welcomed on the airwaves of the most prestigious cable news networks and written about and write op-eds in the prestigious journals of our nation?
I'm, of course, very familiar with the scenario that you're speaking of, because as a person who led the effort against the U.S. march to war in both Iraq and Libya, you know, I understand how one becomes marginalized by challenge of status quo. I ran for president and was treated as a second-rate candidate because I opposed the war. And yet everyone who was on the stage with me had favored it, and they were wrong. You have to ask the question then, what is America all about? Are we simply about imperium? Are we about expanding the reach of what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex? When you consider we have 800 bases in over 130 countries, that we spend more than 10 times what Russia spends annually on the military, that we have a substantial part of the American resources go for war. This machine is a juggernaut that demands to continue to be fed, and anyone who gets in the way, they try to run over. So, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, I used to go to Cleveland Indians baseball games, and there was a guy who would walk up and down the the steps in the bleachers and go, scorecard, scorecard. You can't tell the players without a scorecard. You know, in Washington, D.C., you need a scorecard, which includes who are the defense contractors who benefit from this, who's promoting this in the Pentagon, who's promoting it in the State Department, who's promoting it at the CIA. And once you have that, you kind of can figure out where this thing is going. And, you know, what about the genesis of war? If the American people really understood, if they really understood that our country has tilted in favor of ISIS and Al-Qaeda to knock out a government that's pluralistic, that our country is in aligned with Saudi Arabia, which has funded Wahhabis and is part of this axis of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the U.S., and the U.K., who overtly or covertly has been opening the door for these radical Islamic jihadist interests, I think the American people would be in full revolt. But they're shown pictures of children who have been gassed. And so, you know, there's an emotional response, and everybody closes ranks based on that.
We've talked.
Dennis Kucinich, interviewed by Jeremy Scahill on the Even Dozen of The Intercepted, includes an interview with Maher Arar, the guy that was rendered to Syria during the Bush administration, who doesn't want a U.S. intervention. He wants the U.S. to back out, even though he thinks that it was pretty clear that Syrians did this or were capable of it. And I agree with the latter. I think they're capable of this malfeasance, but I agree with Kucinich that it's insane for them to have done it. And the Ghouta chemical sarin use was pretty much accepted now. I mean, the New York Times has taken it off their list of chemical usage. They've got a long list of chlorine attacks by the Syrian government. But this $1 billion that's gone to aid the Saudi-aligned new warriors, what did Reagan call them? Anyway, I'm going to move right along to a portion of the interview that Robert Perry did. His analysis is changed since Wednesday. He's got a new piece up called Dil Alk, not changed, but it's filled out, particularly because this Theodore Postol fellow has written a longer piece. He had a 14-page initial reaction to the White House evidence that it was a Syrian government operation and blows it to shreds, and he has a further analysis why it's not plausible that it was even an air-delivered attack. I don't know what to make of it, but I know it was a rush to for this demonstration attack, it seems to me, in a large way as well. Perry's latest piece on April 14th is, Did Al-Qaeda Fool the White House Again? My corollary is, did the White House want to be fooled? And he, again, goes through Postol's, who's a military weapons analyst. Anyway, I'll let, he doesn't go into this in this interview. So if you want to find the Consortium News, Al-Qaeda Fool the White House Again article, it's a good read. I need to reread it myself. This is actually about 27 minutes, so we're going to be excerpting it on the fly. See you, Progressive News, coming up at 11. Help support community media and all of its flowerings, if you will. There's not a place to find dissident views on many of the major channels. It was absolutely disgusting to hear that long list of praises of the Cruz weapon, the beautiful weapon. I don't know how Williams can survive since he got demoted to MSNBC because he got caught in a lie about his activities in Iraq, I guess. I don't remember the details. Excuse me. I think I better go to Dennis Bernstein and Robert Perry right now.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says ties with Russia are at a low point and must improve. After 2 hours of talks with President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov in Moscow, he said that the, quote, two foremost nuclear powers cannot have this relationship. Mr. Lavrov said the two sides needed to overcome time bomb issues inherited from Barack Obama's administration. That's an interesting thing for him to say. Tensions have risen since an alleged chemical attack on the rebel-held Syrian town of Khan Sheikhoun last week that left some 89 people dead. The U.S. and its allies blame the Syrian government, and the U.S. fired some 59 cruise missiles at Syria's Sharat air base in response. Syria denied carrying out the chemical attack and has the support of its main ally, Russia, which on Wednesday vetoed a motion brought to the UN Security Council, which would have required Bashar al-Assad's government to cooperate with investigators. Today on Flashpoints, we'll explore in some depth claims by the Trump administration that the Syrian government definitely used sarin gas against its own people. We're joined now by Robert Perry. Bob Perry is the founder and editor of the ConsortiumNews.com and the recipient of the prestigious George Polk Award for Investigative Reporting. He broke the Iran-Contra scandal for the Associated Press and Newsweek in a story today in Consortium News. Perry maintains that the Trump administration has withheld key information from U.S. intelligence, coming in from U.S. intelligence gathering contacts or operatives that claim that Trump laying the blame on the government is wrong, and it may very well have been a rebel group. Bob Perry, sorry for all that long introduction, but I wanted to get it on the record. First of all, before we jump into this, I want people to understand a little bit about your own background. Could you tell us a little bit about your history as a reporter?
Well, sure, Dennis. I started in journalism back in the early 1970s. Not to suggest that I'm really old or anything, but
you're my age, young.
I ended up. It gets younger every year. Yeah. I guess. I started with the Associated Press since 1974, went to the Washington Bureau in 1977, was put on the special assignment team at the beginning of the Reagan administration, covered some of the policy towards Central America and other issues, which led eventually to our discovery of Oliver North's secret arms network. Stories, we, along with my colleague Brian Barger, we wrote the first story about the Contra drug trafficking problem, and we wrote that at the end of 1985. Finally, when the Iran-Contra scandal sort of broke wide open in late 86, I was offered a job at Newsweek and went there in 1987. Worked there for several years, covering some of the developments in the Iran-Contra scandal. Worked for PBS Frontline on some documentaries, and then in the mid 1990s, as the space for serious investigative reporting kept closing down and becoming more and more difficult, I founded Consortium News as an internet site, really the first investigative news site that was dedicated to the internet. Not much was there at the time. It's pretty basic stuff in terms of how things were formatted and so forth. And we've kept this going for 21 years. And during that time, we've covered a number of important stories, and we've expanded quite dramatically the number of writers who contribute their work to us. Ironically, we ended up with a number of former CIA analysts who have write for us, and we've become the home for the so-called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which they publish memos once in a while on topics, which they send to us first, and we put them up. So we've done a lot of serious investigative work. We try to make it accessible to internet readers, in that we try to make the stories move. We try to be very tight in how we write them, but very careful in terms of how we source them. And we've done a number of historical record stories as well as current events.
All right, let's talk about your story that came up today. Trump withholds Syria sarin evidence. Could you give us a little context here, Bob, in terms of the background, how you built up to getting this and the way in which this came forth?
Well, I mean, this story directly relates to the report that was put out yesterday, a very curious report, four pages, was put together by the White House, although it purports to reflect the intelligence community's view of the April 4th chemical weapons incident in Idlib province in the northern part of Syria. The problem we have with this, and it's been a problem that I must say has been recurring with the U.S. government now for quite a while, is that they make assertions and they do not provide us the evidence. They tell us, they say, trust us. And this is not, I wouldn't say this is entirely special to the Trump administration. We saw it also, of course, during the Obama administration, the George W. Bush administration. We keep going back and seeing the same pattern of where the U.S. government makes very dangerous and serious assertions and doesn't support them with evidence. What we've tried to do is to, first of all, challenge that and say, you know, there should be evidence here. We shouldn't just be told to believe it. And secondly, we've tried to analyze what is available to see if it stacks up. In this case, this report was very, very thin in terms of what it purported to say and then back up. They appear to be claiming that they have geospatial material information that supports their claim that this attack was carried out by the Syrian government. But again, they don't want to share that with anyone. They claim this is sources and methods and shouldn't be revealed. But the fact is that we all basically know that the United States has spy satellites. I mean, and the U.S. isn't alone in having spy satellites. Every major country does. And that they're pretty good in terms of keeping an eye on things. And in the case of Syria, they are. It's a very intensive effort. This is a hot area. This is an area where the U.S. has very strong interests and has devoted a great many resources of this type. So the spy satellites would presumably see pretty much everything that happened down below. Now, obviously, there can be problems. You have cloud cover and so forth, and some of these things are not entirely perfect. But they're extremely powerful in terms of their capabilities. So it's the sort of thing that if you're going to create a situation that brings nuclear armed Russia and nuclear armed the United States to a confrontation, you are putting the world in grave jeopardy. This is an extermination potential event. And we're talking about extermination of the human species here if these two nuclear powers go off and start blasting away their nuclear arsenals. So when you're getting into that area, the requirement for supporting what you claim should be at the highest levels. And we've certainly in the past, we have seen presidents waive these kinds of concerns to prove what they're saying. Obviously, in 1962, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, John F. Kennedy exposed the capabilities of the U-2 spy planes in terms of to show what was happening in Cuba, in terms of the Soviet Union placing missiles there. In 1983, when there was a shoot-down of the Soviets of the Korean Airline Flight 007, Ronald Reagan released information showing that the U.S. had intercepted the command and control communications between the ground and the Soviet pilots. It's also true that Reagan kind of doctored the transcripts, but what he revealed is that we had those capabilities. So in extreme cases, and certainly important cases like this, there's really no reason why the United States can't say, here's what we've got. We're going to show it to you. We're not going to ask you to trust us. We're going to prove it. But, you know, that's not the way it happened here. And the other odd thing to me is that for the first 2 months of the Trump administration, nobody believed a word that came out of Trump's mouth or anything they heard from his administration. But now suddenly the New York Times and other major news organizations are falling over themselves to believe anything that relates to this. They're not asking for any proof. We're asking for proof. We're saying if you don't want to prove it, don't ask us to believe it.
All right. Let me read a key paragraph in your story here. It's under the subheading, A Drone Mystery. According to a source, I assume this is your source, the analysts struggled to identify whose drone it was and where it originated. What drone are we talking about now?
Well, apparently, in reviewing this material, and some of these reviews occurred after Trump had already fired off these missiles, these 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian military base, killing roughly 15 people. By the way, including like 9 civilians and 4 children, according to a Syrian media report. But the CIA analysts and other, you know, the geospatial analysts have been reviewing exactly the material we were talking about. They have a very powerful body of material to review. Now, they're looking for who might have delivered the alleged sarin or chemical weapon bomb.
They being who? Who's looking?
This is the U.S. analysts are trying to. We're trying to figure out exactly what happened, which is their job, which they should do. Now, in the process. And this was sort of end of last week when I heard this, they were having trouble figuring out where this plane might have come from, and they weren't seeing the planes. That at the time they thought that the bomb might have been delivered, but they did spot a drone, what appeared to be a drone aircraft, and then they tried to trace it back to where it might have come from. Whose drone it was, and these are not always easy, and there were some technical problems apparently in terms of exactly what they could see and what, but they believe that it came from. I was told by the source they believe that it came from a base inside Jordan, a special operations base that was a joint Saudi-Israeli base in support of the Syrian rebels. Now. You know, I'm not sure what happened to that. If, in terms of where that analysis stands, the report released yesterday by the White House said that they were certain that the alleged sarin bomb was delivered by a Syrian aircraft. But again, they will not say how they know that or what the actual basis is. So. The question is, did they disprove what I was hearing? Did they sort of brush it aside? Maybe they found something else that clarified this point? Or are they just trying to ignore that and move the debate in a different direction without having evidence? The larger issue here is, do you trust the Trump White House? This report was not prepared by the Central Intelligence Agency. It was not prepared by the Director of National.
You're talking about the report that came out of the White House, as opposed
yesterday.
To what you were hearing from the source. Okay, I just want to keep this.
Right. There was a report that came out yesterday, 4 pages, which was supposedly reflecting the views of the intelligence community, but it wasn't. It didn't come from the intelligence community. It came from the White House, and it did not. It was not something that had the imprimatur of the CIA or the DNI. The various intelligence agencies. It was not an intelligence estimate, which is like the gold standard among the intelligence community. So what we're asked to believe is this basically a political document produced by the White House to support an action that President Trump had already taken, and asserting that they not only know for certainty that the attack was carried out on April 4th by the Syrian military, but that they also the White House also accused the Russian government of covering up for that attack by suggesting that there might be other explanations. Now, you know, there are other problems with that too, in that if you're trying to do any kind of review like this, you're always going to start with trying to figure things out, and there you should look at different options. But here, the White House is saying, if you didn't immediately accept our analysis, which came within, you know, basically hours of the event, you were somehow part of some Russian disinformation plan. But there are a lot of very serious American analysts, including many of these former U.S. intelligence people that send their articles into me, who have a very different view. And I was even hearing from intelligence people from the Middle East immediately before the attack that they did not believe that the Syrian government had carried this out, that they thought there could have been an accident where the chemicals were accidentally ruptured and released, or could have been some kind of a staged event by Al Qaeda trying to create a crisis. So there are other options that needed to be reviewed seriously. But because of the rush to judgment and then the rush to retaliate, once the president makes those kinds of decisions, it becomes extremely difficult for anyone to conduct an investigation, for obvious reasons. If you were to come up with a different conclusion, conclude that this sarin gas, whatever it was, this poison gas was supplied in some other way that came from this, say, a drone that came out of Jordan, or if you decided that it was, or it looked like it was a staged event by Al Qaeda to sort of create a crisis, or anything of that sort, you would immediately put the president in a very bad light, because he's already carried out a retaliatory attack that has killed innocent civilians. So that's really kind of almost an impeachable offense. So if you're working for the government, for the U.S. government, you're not likely to want to put your career on the line like that. And frankly, we've had cases in the past where when the president has said one thing and the facts come out another way, those facts are often kept given high degrees of secrecy and shoved away, not to be seen really sometimes for generations. So this is a very difficult situation, because what the Trump administration is doing here is setting up a confrontation with nuclear-armed Russia. Now, and maybe they're doing it in part because they're responding to the Russiagate conspiracy theories that have been dominating the press for several months, and they're trying to show they're tougher on Russia than anything. But the reality is, you could be creating momentum for a nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia. This is not something to play with. This is not a game that we have in Washington. It's being treated that way from both the mainstream press and the Democrats and Republicans. It's being treated like a game, but it's really putting the lives of literally billions of people in jeopardy. So in that sort of situation, it just seems, as a fundamental rule, I, as a journalist, I think we should always have evidence, and we should always try to review what is going to be proven as opposed to what's claimed. But in this circumstance, the demand for that kind of evidence should be much, much greater. And instead, we get these sort of cavalier reports that are essentially political in nature, coming out of the White House.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Robert Perry. He is the editor, founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He has an article up on Consortium News, Trump Withholds Syria Sarin Evidence. And you also point out, which is, significant, and I don't think it's over the top, as you point out, that both the director of Central Intelligence, and I say it that way, Bob, because I want people to understand that the CIA director, Central Intelligence means all the intelligence is supposed to come through the director of Central Intelligence and the directorate there. And so the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, and the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, are not in the frame meeting when all of this is being discussed in Mar-a-Lago.
I think I'll leave that one hanging in the air. Yeah, they wrote out their analysis on napkins. That's Dennis Bernstein of the program Flashpoints, with his regular guest from Consortium News, Robert Perry. As I mentioned, the most recent article that superseded his Wednesday analysis was, has Al-Qaeda fooled the White House again? And he's claiming that looks to him that it put up job by Al-Qaeda. And my corollary, as I mentioned earlier, is, did they want to be fooled? There's a fundraising event for the Refugee Center Mutual Assistance Group tonight. It's pretty expensive by my standards. And it says that you have to RSVP by April 6th, but I guess if there were still some seats available, they have entertainment, including the great, and I'm sure they'll have their mojo working, particularly Don Clark, the Painkillers Blues Band are holding forth at this event. It is at the Round Bar.